We're talking about medical misinformation and vaccine hesitancy here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We are bombarded with information that affects our health. It's all over social media. We try to weed out the untruths, but it's really hard because falsehoods, they lurk around every corner in science and medicine, it seems. Have you believed something that you found out later to be false? What did you learn from the experience? How did it make you feel? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Seema Yasmin is an Emmy Award-winning journalist, physician, and clinical assistant professor at Stanford University. Her book is called Viral BS, Medical Myths, and Why We Fall for Them. Dr. Yasmin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
As you watch this COVID health crisis unfold, what has happened to health information?
I will say that watching it unfold has unfortunately felt very frustratingly predictable in that not only did we know that a pandemic was imminent, that would certainly happen at some point, but we knew that when viruses spread or when any pathogen spreads, that in tandem, you have misinformation and disinformation that spreads as well. Some people call this a misinfodemic. And that's exactly what we've seen this time around. So not only are we all dealing with this global pandemic, but we're also, as you just mentioned, bombarded with medical myths and hoaxes and also tons of accurate information as well that can just feel overwhelming. We're learning things sometimes by the hour, literally, you know, day by day as the pandemic evolves. And it can be really hard to keep up, really hard to separate the fact from the fiction. And that can manifest then as perhaps not great decisions that we make about our own health and about public health. So we really have to address this issue of not just a virus spreading, but also of inaccurate information spreading as well.
What's difficult is that we expect scientists to have the answers, right? To have all the information. And they, too, are trying to get wrap their arms around what this virus is, its oddities, its, you know, I mean, there's so much that they're trying to discover, too, and the flood of academic journal information. So that is happening in parallel.
Absolutely. And Kate, I think what's happened is not only are we all, scientists and everybody else, kind of playing catch up in terms of like, what do we know about this virus? What do we know about new treatments for this virus? But at the same time, it's not just the virus we're having to learn about and teach. We're kind of having to either remind people or maybe even teach them for the first time how the scientific process itself works. So if folks remember back to March and April of 2020, you may remember how much Dr. Fauci kind of came under attack for changing his perspective on mask wearing. Mm. 1 month he had said, we don't need everyone to wear a surgical kind of cloth mask. Then he said, no, we do. And for some people, I think for many, unfortunately, the response was, he doesn't know what he's talking about. The scientists don't know what's going on. And actually, what he had done was what good scientists should do, which is to say, science is not a bunch of static facts. Science is a process of asking a question, doing experiments, and learning. And what he did was say, I know I said one thing last month, but now there's new and better evidence that supports something different, so I'm going to give you different advice. And unfortunately, I think because of a lack of scientific literacy, it didn't quite land that way.
Lack of scientific literacy, but what about the politicizing of public health, the politicizing of wearing masks? What effects has that had?
It's had a huge and I think nasty and negative effect in that we are going through something historic, a generation-defining crisis that's going to be in the history books. This could have been a moment that united us. We're all in this together. This is deathly. It's horrible. And instead, it's become something so divisive and partisan. You wear a mask if you're on this side. You don't wear a mask if you're on that side. And one thing that I've noticed, and I think other disinformation scholars have noticed too, is as we are tracking the spread of misinformation and disinformation, at least for me, what I used to see around vaccines was, oh, the misinformation and disinformation would be vaccines are unsafe, vaccines are toxic, vaccines cause autism. None of that is true, but that was kind of the messaging. More and more what I see is messages online that say getting vaccinated is in opposition to the American way of life. And now with masks, I see, you know, wearing a mask goes against the idea of American freedom. And so we're not just having to counter false beliefs about the science or correcting folks about how vaccines work and what's in them. It's really having to counter sometimes a deep-seated personal and political belief that can be very challenging.
We're talking with physician Seema Yasmin, who's the author of the book Viral BS, Medical Myths and Why We Fall for Them. Do you want to learn how to debunk medical misinformation that's spread online? Have you believed something that you found out later to be false? What did that experience teach you? How did you feel? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Yasmin, let's talk about the COVID vaccine, the rollout that's underway, vaccines being distributed nationwide. What level of vaccine hesitancy do you see?
It's actually shifting. So it's kind of this moving target we've been tracking since middle of 2020, I would say, when it comes to the COVID vaccine specifically. And I have seen in some of these national surveys of American attitudes, more folks being willing to get vaccinated, at least before the vaccines arrived. Now, of course, the issue isn't even so much convincing folks. It's the logistical issues of rolling out the vaccine and making sure everyone can get them. But when it comes to vaccine hesitancy, I think something really interesting is happening right now in that some of the folks who are in Group 1A and Group 1B, high priority to get vaccinated, including healthcare workers, are saying, no, thank you. And even folks who work in long-term care facilities, we heard from the Ohio governor a few days ago about concern that potentially even half of all Ohio long-term care facility staff were refusing the vaccine. And that may be because of concerns that they're so high priority and not many others have already been vaccinated. I think many have valid concerns about how it's been developed within 10 months. And I say valid concerns because I think people haven't been offered the context that they need to understand, well, actually, it was developed in 10 months really safely without cutting corners for reasons 1, 2, and 3. And, there are actual reasons that give folks that context. But when it comes to vaccine hesitancy, it's interesting that those numbers shift in terms of who is saying they'll get vaccinated, how many are saying they'll refuse. And I think the fact that it shifts shows how important the communication and the messaging around it is.
Because I was going to ask you about that. What impact does it have to see your vice president, for instance, getting the shot or someone high profile in your life being vaccinated and saying something on social media or it getting posted and you seeing that? What effect does that have?
Yes, I was just going to say, it can be very influential. And I know that some high-ranking officials getting vaccinated really upset people because they were saying, hold on a second, these are the same folks that were calling COVID a hoax. They've been attacking scientists. Why did they get to get vaccinated? There are, of course, national security reasons for those people to get vaccinated. But also, millions of people look up to them and believe what they do. So for those people, say Donald Trump or Vice President Mike Pence, rolling up their sleeve to get vaccinated shows that they have faith in the FDA regulatory process, shows that they believe this pandemic is real, that the virus is real and the vaccines are safe. So we certainly learn about those spheres of influence and those people that can really encourage others that, hey, I'm doing this, so you might want to consider doing this too.
We have physician Seema Yasmin helping us navigate medical misinformation and how to separate out the good information from the bad, especially as we look at this pandemic. Clinicians, how do you handle debunking myths that your patients bring up? Are you assertive in presenting accurate information? Are you calm and take care to listen and hear them out? How does your patient respond? How do you build trust? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Yasmin here on the Ideas Network. We are deflating untruths in science and medicine. How poignant in a global pandemic where health information is flying at us fast. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dr. Seema Yasmin grew up in a family where conspiracy theories swirled around her. And when she was a young doctor in London, she describes being sympathetic to a pregnant patient who rolled her eyes, crossed her arms, and refused to take a prescription. was out of fear of poisoning the baby that Yasmin says she just couldn't break through. Has someone in your family refused a medication or perhaps the COVID vaccine out of fear of what they've heard about it? 800-642-1234. The book is called Viral BS, and Dr. Yasmin is with us for the hour. Early in the pandemic, Dr. Yasmin, President Trump predicted that COVID would not be any worse than the flu, but the flu is really bad. Can you explain your experience in 2014 working in the Dallas area while Ebola was spreading in West Africa and this paradox you saw about how people viewed each illness?
Right. And so there was even this story I heard that I mentioned in the book of this mother in Texas kind of taking her kid to the pediatrician's office and saying, I want my kid to get the Ebola vaccine, you know, because there was a case of Ebola in Dallas, one case. And the pediatrician said, well, I'm sorry, we don't have a vaccine for Ebola, because we didn't back then. And the mother's adamant, no, I want my kid to get the Ebola vaccine. And the pediatrician says, well, we don't have that vaccine. And even if I did, I kind of wouldn't give it to your kid here in Texas. But you know what? It's flu season. Let me give your kid the flu shot. And the mother says, oh, no, I don't believe in those things. And I heard multiple of those stories that just made me think, oh, yeah, we humans, we're not always quite good at being rational about risk and about fear. Flu kills tens of thousands of Americans each year. I've had patients die from flu very quickly and in very surprising ways. And yet flu just sounds kind of pedestrian, happens every year, right? People confuse, or they had a cold, but then they remember it as the flu and it really wasn't the flu. And so this risk of Ebola, this kind of foreign, mysterious disease, can feel more threatening and more real than the flu, which actually is more likely to kill you.
Yeah, you know, during that time with that first person to die of Ebola in Dallas, I was 2 hours away from you. I know you were at the Dallas Morning News there or just starting there. I was in across the border in Louisiana in Shreveport covering this as well. And Louisiana, very fearful that the Ebola would be moving into Louisiana.
Right.
The fear was palpable. How much is fear a part of how we view these vaccinations?
It can really color our perception of risk. And I don't even remember, you know, that time when we were covering Ebola back in 2014 and 2015, there was the whole facts, not fear thing. People were spreading so much misinformation, just getting like really riled up. And, you know, as journalists, we have to admit as well that sometimes the press coverage was hysterical when it came to talking about Ebola and kind of inciting that panic and fear. It can really get in the way of people assessing the information, weighing the risk. When you're overwhelmingly scared, just think about times in your life when you've been scared, it doesn't always help you make the best decisions. And so it's important to have that healthy level of fear. For example, with COVID-19, it's a real disease. Young people are becoming very sick from it for long periods of time. I think a small amount of fear can be healthy, but when it starts to color the way you assess information and weigh the risk, it sometimes is counterproductive.
You grew up in a family of what you call conspiracy theorists. What about your family's experience contributed to how you see the world today and what you're trying to do?
I should say, so that I don't annoy my family too much, even more, it wasn't just us, it was our entire community. And I think that helps me understand that people might believe things that are really false because everyone around them in their day-to-day world does, and humans can be quite tribalist. We need to belong. And so it's easier to say, oh, yeah, I do believe that. I am going to believe that. That belief helps me fit into this family and this community. I have a lot of empathy because of the fact that I used to believe a ton of conspiracy theories. I mentioned that kind of straight up as a confession in the book. And I think I have a lot of empathy because I understand how it is that even an absurd-sounding conspiracy theory can be quite believable. Because in the context of history, where absurd things have actually happened, you can then start to believe absurd things that haven't happened. And so in my conversations now with people who believe conspiracy theories, and also I do a lot of training for healthcare workers, teaching us how to be better, more compassionate, have more empathy when talking to patients who don't share our beliefs, who don't believe our evidence, for example, how to do that. I will say that I am human, and so I mess this up too. And even though I teach the classes on this, in my family WhatsApp group, I sometimes lose my cool when the vaccine conspiracies are spread there and cousins are like, oh, I saw this on Facebook, and I will do all the things you're not supposed to do to have a constructive conversation about the misinformation, because sometimes it's just really frustrating.
We're talking with Dr. Seema Yasmin, who's a clinical assistant professor at Stanford. She's helping us to understand why medical misinformation spreads and what we can do about it. Dr. Yasmin, what recommendations do you have then for clinicians who are sitting there with their patient in front of them, or maybe on the video screen in these days, but you know, trying to be able to tell them, no, that is untrue? Where do you go? What do you tell a clinician?
I tell them what not to do initially. Don't just bombard people with facts, because that's what we love to do. Scientists, you know, we love our data sets and we love our data points. And we think, oh, if I just counter your false information, your false belief with the quote unquote truth, that will fix everything. And actually, we've seen time and time again how that is like pouring facts onto a polarized conversation can be like pouring kerosene onto a fire. It just blows everything up. And I'm sure folks even heard about this idea of the backfire effect, where when you challenge someone's deepest convictions with contradictory evidence, their false beliefs can get even stronger. They can just dig their heels in deeper and start to like guard their false belief like it's precious information. And so what we say is, instead of bombarding folks with that, and this might sound counterintuitive, hear them out. Because by hearing them out, you'll start to understand where their belief comes from. You know, six patients who all are vaccine hesitant may have six very different reasons for being vaccine hesitant, and therefore a one-size-fits-all message for them won't fit. You may need to tailor that message in six different ways.
What happens if that message doesn't get through? And, you know, your patient may be really sick. I mean, once you had a patient who just wouldn't take the medication in the hospital, and, you know, their life was at risk.
So sometimes the information may not get through, those conversations may not go well at first, but I think still by using some of those elements of compassion, empathy, listening, trying to understand, not overwhelming with facts, can still serve you in the long run. The second conversation or the third conversation might be better, but I still think that coming back to this idea of trying not to get frustrated, really trying to understand where they're coming from, almost kind of like doing a root cause analysis of how did they end up here, this sick, was using this medicine, still works better than, no, you're wrong, I'm a physician, I have evidence, and I'm right. That often just leads to real people being at loggerheads.
You know, you present all of these questions in your book, 46 of them, a wide variety of medical questions that you then answer. Does playing American football give players brain damage? Does the birth control pill cause depression? Is MSG addictive? Was this a deliberative choice to frame these issues, medical information, as questions? Why did you do that?
It was deliberate, because I often get bombarded with these questions myself. Everything about, do vaccines cause autism, to are the chemtrails that airplanes leave in the sky poisonous? And this book actually started off 5 or 6 years ago as a column in the Dallas Morning News called Debunked, where I just respond to readers' questions. And I'd get questions all the time, because people have been told, you know, everything about from like starving a fever to feeding a cold, or the other way around. I can't even remember now. And so I would really enjoy like dissecting that myth, trying to figure out where did it come from, and trying to balance it with the accurate information. And so I kept the book in that same format. It was very hard to narrow it down, because there are so many medical myths and hoaxes out there.
Including about aspirin, you know, some studies show it might also prevent cancer. A 1982 study showed how a daily intake of a low-dose aspirin or baby aspirin reduces a person's risk of heart attack. Give us the context of these studies.
Yeah, so we've known about aspirin being good for the heart in some people since the 80s. And since then, we've had, I think, even more interesting studies about the role of aspirin in preventing cancer. And you think, wait, why would that even work? And it turns out that at least with cancer that's already in the body that is going to spread, it uses our platelets to spread. Platelets are those cells that help us form a clot when we're injured. And spreading cancer cells can use platelets as a cloak around them to kind of avoid our immune system. And anyone who takes aspirin, baby aspirin for their heart will know that aspirin is an anti-platelet medicine. And so that there have been these huge studies that show in some people who already have cancer, in others who have a history of colorectal cancer, for example, that aspirin can help them prevent further disease. The guidelines are quite specific about which age groups should use it for this reason specifically and who shouldn't, but there have been some pretty large and pretty convincing studies about the role of aspirin, not just in helping our hearts, but in protecting against cancer too.
Talking with Dr. Seema Yasmin, directs the Stanford University Health Communication Initiative. Her new book tackles 46 myths in science and medicine, helps arm us with knowledge about health threats. Do you want to learn how to debunk medical misinformation spread online? What do you do on social media when something looks disputable? Does a family member or friend disagree with you about something you hold as true? What would you like to say about it? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Dr. Seema Yasmin after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're navigating the wide world of medical misinformation and exploring a new book called Viral BS. We have Dr. Seema Yasmin helping us here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Yasmin is a clinical assistant professor at Stanford, teaching science journalism and global health storytelling and researching the spread of misinfodemics, as we've been talking about. That's a term used to describe when online misinformation leads to the spread of disease, especially concerning amid COVID. Are you worried about the spread of unscientific information about how to treat COVID? Do you work in public health or in a clinical setting? What are the most common COVID myths you're encountering? Join in at 800-642-1234. And Dr. Yasmin is our guide. You have been looking at history, and you say that history is the kerosene that ignites conspiracy theories and fuels new hoaxes. And thinking about the unethical science, the unethical Tuskegee syphilis experiment, how is mistrust of government or medicine a part of these myths and misinformation?
So we have this history in public health and in medicine where really terrible things were done to vulnerable people by doctors, often by government-employed doctors. Tuskegee is one example of hundreds of poor black men in Alabama. For over 40 years, these experiments didn't end until 1972, where these men, some of them had syphilis, and they were never told what disease they had, that even when penicillin was discovered as a cure for their disease, they weren't given the medicine. And so when you think about the impact that has now, there are people who are alive when the syphilis Tuskegee trials studies were happening. There are others who've just grown up knowing about it. And even just a few years ago, actually, there was a really bad tuberculosis outbreak in Alabama. And there were folks I know in public health who were very frustrated. They said, oh, this TB outbreak is so bad. We are offering cash incentives to locals to come and get tested. People don't trust us. They're not coming. And I was thinking, but look at where the TB outbreak is. It's about a 1.5 hour drive from where the Tuskegee experiments happened. That legacy continues, and it makes people really wary of those in white coats. It makes people really wary of governments. And of course, it's not an isolated incident. There are many experiments like that. It's also not just a historical phenomenon. You know, medical racism is real. Right now, black patients still have their pain and their illnesses underdiagnosed and not believed. And so when you get to a COVID-19 vaccination campaign and you're like, hey, everyone, trust us, it doesn't quite hit home that way because people have different histories and different cultural contexts for how they feel about science and about doctors.
And there can be a ripple effect for decades, even after these horrible experiments ended.
Oh, absolutely. And we talk about the experiments, but it's just so pervasive. Some of the buildings that you see in medical schools, they're named after really prominent doctors from history who, when you read about them, they were fascists. They were eugenicists. They believed that black people and people of color were less intelligent. Even some of the gynecological surgeries we do, the speculum that we use was invented by a man who experimented on enslaved black women, didn't give them anesthesia. So it's like these atrocities are baked into our system. And I really think that without kind of washing our dirty linen in public, atoning for that, we can't just say to people that we have evidence, we have facts, please believe us, because look how we've misused that power in the past.
You know, just a little bit here, thinking about your question around how geography, how your zip code can affect your health, which is another question that you have in the book. How does where you live affect how long you live?
It can predict your life expectancy, and your zip code can be a more powerful predictor of your wellness and your life than your genetic code. I think so often we put the onus on people, we point the finger, you need to eat right, you need to do this, but actually where they live, whether there's a library there or a prison there, can have more impact on their wellness than those things that they try to do, like eating right. Of course, you need to do all of them, but your zip code absolutely can be a predictor. Here where I live in the Bay Area, a kid that's born in the Oakland Hills is expected to live 15 years longer than a kid born a few miles away in West Oakland. I'm sure there are similar disparities in Wisconsin too. It can be really, really stark. It can be more than a decade of difference in how long somebody might live just based on where they live.
You also dive into the debate around e-cigarettes. And in 2019, some young people who use them got sick and died. We saw that here in Wisconsin. Why isn't there consensus on whether e-cigarettes are safe or not?
Absolutely. There are such differences. So, for example, in the UK, where I went to medical school, where I trained as a doctor initially, you can have e-cigarettes prescribed by your doctor within the National Health Service, because the evidence that the folks in England are looking at, they say that e-cigarettes can be really, really helpful in smoking cessation, that it can help people quit. On the other hand, I live in the Bay Area, where San Francisco last year became the first city in the state to actually ban the sale of e-cigarettes. So talk about a massive difference in opinion and policy about the safety of these. And of course, as you mentioned, I think Wisconsinites will remember especially how in the spring of 2019, there were young men in the state, also in Illinois and Oregon, who got seriously sick with lung disease, wound up in the ICU, and some of them sadly even died at a very young age because of what they'd been smoking inside the e-cigarettes. And it was specifically a thickening agent, vitamin C acetate, that was added to some of the liquids they were putting in there. But the evidence is different. There is different evidence depending on what you look like that can shift the policy in a wildly different way. So a ban in San Francisco, prescriptions in the UK.
We're talking with Dr. Seema Yasmin, who served as an officer in the Epidemic Intelligence Service at the CDC for some time. She has investigated disease outbreaks. Her new book is about medical information and how to debunk misinformation. You can join in with information that you heard. What do you want debunked? What do you want the truth on? 800-642-1234. Dr. Yasmin, there is data that claimed 250,000 Americans die each year because of medical errors. How is this data looked at? What can you help us understand with medical errors?
So folks might remember a few years ago, there were these really stark headlines that you're more likely to die from medical mistake than from a car crash in America. And there were these studies that had huge numbers that basically, if you followed the numbers, it implied that half of the people who died in a hospital in America died because of a medical mistake. So you start kind of like scratching your head thinking, really? That's like a really high proportion. So what I did was I looked back at where did the numbers come from. And what the folks in these studies had done was aggregated smaller studies from different states, and then kind of extrapolated, extended those numbers as if they applied for the whole country. And that's where I think actually errors in the study came into play, because they looked at specific populations of patients in New York, in Ohio, in Utah, for example, and then just extending that as if it applied the same everywhere, for everyone, for every kind of patient.
Oh, skewing the data.
Yeah, it really led to misleading data and to scary headlines. And I think that's what it comes down to, Kate. I mean, I'm not arguing that any number of deaths from medical errors is acceptable. It's not. But if you scare people to the point that they're scared to go to a hospital, I think that could be really detrimental for personal health and for public health, too. So I think those numbers were not accurate.
Yeah, and certainly amid COVID, people have been afraid to go to the ER, afraid to go to get chest pains checked out, or worse. How do you navigate that amid COVID when ERs have been full, but people still have other emergencies?
Yeah, and we're going to look back, and in fact, we're already doing the analysis now, where we'll see people didn't just die of COVID during the pandemic. They died from other diseases that, had there not been a pandemic, would have been treated, would have been diagnosed earlier. They would have got the care that they needed. It's really hard to give blanket advice about this, because if you live in the area that I live in, our hospitals are massively overwhelmed. Folks are sitting in ambulances for 6 or 7 hours, not able to get into the ER because it's so backed up. And of course, that could be a person who's been in a car accident. It could be a person with chest pain. It does vary from region to region, but we're asking people to make really educated decisions about what kind of pain they might be in, what kind of condition they might be in. Is that something where they should seek medical help? Or in the context of a pandemic, is it something where they can stay at home and recuperate? But it's really tricky and really sad.
Let's bring in David now in La Crosse with thoughts on e-cigarettes. Hi, David.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that the claim that e-cigarettes caused a bunch of deaths in 2019 is wildly misleading. It was actually illegally manufactured cartridges that caused a lot of those lung problems in Wisconsin, because they were using a substance that is not intended for e-cigarette cartridges.
David,
and this
is
one of those things that leads to the misinformation that your guest was speaking of.
Dr. Yasmin, I want Dr. Yasmin to jump in here. The illegal manufacturing of cartridges.
Yes, as I mentioned, it was the vitamin E acetate in the e-cigarettes that was causing the outbreak of lung disease that mostly affected young men and caused deaths in Oregon, and also caused illness in Illinois and in Wisconsin. So in that outbreak, the CDC investigator said it's what's in the cartridges. It's the vitamin E acetate that's being used to thicken the substance in the cartridge. However, there is still a debate about the standard ingredients included in many e-cigarettes, because they contain glycerol and propylene glycol, and the manufacturers say, well, those are safe. But other people, including those in the movie industry who use those as fogging agents, say, no, when you're exposed to those, they can cause breathing problems. So that's why many are not saying blanketly that e-cigarettes are safe. And even in England, where they're prescribed, the language from Public Health England is there are risks associated with e-cigarettes. However, they believe the risks are lower than for regular cigarettes. And that's why they're willing to prescribe them to those who they want to help quit cigarettes.
Dr. Seema Yasmin, a health communication researcher at Stanford, explaining the threats of medical misinformation with your insights as well, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Seema Yasmin. She researches the spread of misinformation and disinformation in the world of science and medicine. And her new book tackles dozens of health questions to get to the bottom of falsehoods. She gives examples of where the beliefs may have originated. And she's with us for 10 more minutes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. So you include a toolkit, a BS detection toolkit, and these are steps to protect against false news. How did you go about putting together this toolkit?
I've talked to a lot of fact checkers and a lot of journalists who have to do that kind of digging to figure out, wait, can we print this? Can we air this? Or can we not? And I think some of them are straightforward enough that the public can be using those. I do think that one of the best and earliest steps is just pausing. When you're hit with new information, especially on social media, take a minute before you retweet it, before you believe it, before you share it widely, and then do some due diligence. So even during COVID, I think people have seen in the last few months some images going viral, images saying, oh, here's a mass grave of COVID patients in this area, for example. If you just take a second, it doesn't take long at all on the internet to do a reverse image search, you find out the image was 3 years old, way before the pandemic, and has nothing to do with COVID-19. So I think because it can feel overwhelming and like, oh, we just can't deal with this issue of false information, it's good to know actually there are some steps that we can take to protect ourselves.
Well, and even knowing how to do a reverse image search, I mean, you have to have a certain level of skill set.
Yeah. You do. But I think even knowing that it's there is helpful. Like, oh, that's a thing that I can do. I can check the veracity of a photo even. And so that's why I've included it there with some pointers about where to go to do that so that people know that that's available to them.
And photos, too, are very hard to discern what is real and what has been, distorted.
Yeah, and they're really powerful, right? Images are really powerful. They stick with you. They convey a lot of information in one fell swoop. And so knowing that you have that availability of these engines online where you plug in the picture, you can either link the URL or the file itself. You can just take a screenshot when you see a picture, and it will tell you when that came to be and where it came from. And so you'll see, for example, oh, that's a photo from 2011. That doesn't have anything to do with COVID.
How does being a journalist inform how you are as a physician and vice versa?
It's made me really change my attitude to data because I trained as an epidemiologist after I went to medical school. So we're obsessed with numbers. We love loads of numbers. We love big data sets with millions and millions of data. And when you're a journalist, you know, you think about your anecdotal lead, you're thinking, okay, I have to tell a story about the pandemic. This is huge. So many affected. But in my story, I need to tell a story. I need to bring it home about one individual, one family, maybe one community. That's really uncomfortable for an epidemiologist because to us, one data point could be an outlier. But certainly going to journalism school and my motivation for going to journalism school after serving in the Epidemic Intelligence Service was we're not that great in medicine and public health at conveying information. So doing journalism and working as a journalist taught me about the power of the story and really finding good ways to connect with people before you hit them with the statistics.
How do you view the role of Dr. Anthony Fauci in our country?
Oh, I wish him a long life, and I'm really sad that he has a security detail. I think it's a lot for one person to bear, but I do think he's a fantastic scientist. I think that he has served under multiple administrations and dealt with the HIV/AIDS pandemic, Zika, Ebola, now COVID, of course. He's someone that I think kind of epitomizes the diligent and humble scientist. But really, his role has shown us how divisive and how political this whole pandemic has become. And I really wish it hadn't gone there.
Yeah, I saw some reports, though, that his role has encouraged more people to apply for medical school. And
I think we're calling it the Fauci bump, I think. And that gave me a lot of hope last year. You know, there are times when you're just like, oh, my gosh, we've lost thousands of healthcare workers, not just doctors, nurses, respiratory techs, you name it, to COVID-19, and we've seen how disrespected doctors have been, even by their institutions in many cases. And so the fact that many young people, more than usual, when I go to medical school, kind of gave me faith in humanity, like, oh, the future's going to be bright. People are still encouraged, still want to learn science, and still want to help people.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Seema Yasmin, who is a medical doctor, author of the book Viral BS, Medical Myths and Why We Fall for Them. Dr. Yasmin, has your family changed as you have really put these myths front and center? Do they see how they view the world in a different way because of what you have done?
I think a little bit. I mean, maybe I'm kidding myself, but I hope so. I hope that they've become better critics of some of the false information that they see on Facebook or that they hear from word of mouth. At least they have me to like run it by. But it is hard. My family is Muslim, and so they are acutely aware of how Muslims are misrepresented in the media. And there's a ton of data to support that in terms of the xenophobia and Islamophobia. So it's really difficult to be like, well, I come from a group that is misrepresented in the media, that people are now telling me to believe what I see in the media regarding COVID-19. That's difficult because they know they've seen falsehoods even in reputable legacy newspapers. And so we're always contending with that. And that's why it's important, I think, that we have these conversations, that we hold journalists to account too, that we make sure a diverse range of stories are included in our reporting.
Circling back to COVID-19 now, what are you watching for as the vaccine rollout continues, albeit slow? And what should we who are not in the medical profession have an eye on?
So you mentioned the vaccine rollout being slow, and I'm actually keeping an eye on that particular thing because for many who are vaccine hesitant, I've heard from them saying the fact that the rollout is botched, the fact that many fewer people have been vaccinated than the government said will be vaccinated by now, actually engenders more distrust, actually makes them think, wait, things aren't going how they said. I was kind of waving. I was going to get the vaccine, but now they said they're going to change it. They're talking about changing doses, or they're talking about spacing them out differently. Like, it can make people more hesitant. So I'm keeping an eye on that. For everyone else out there who's like, oh my God, this is just going on and on, I don't know what to believe, I do think that developing a media diet can be a useful thing. Basically, this means instead of like checking your Twitter feed every hour, like maybe I do, so maybe I'm being very hypocritical here, but you can develop a diet where you say, I'm going to check the news from these particular sites, from this particular public radio station for half an hour at this time of the day, 20 minutes here. I'm going to do another half an hour kind of early evening. That can just make you feel less overwhelmed, make you more diligent about doing your fact checking because you're not constantly bombarded by information, and kind of make you deliberate about which sites and which radio stations you do listen to. I think that can be helpful.
In our last minute together, I'm wondering what message you would have for public health workers who may be very tired at this moment and in some instances even targeted because of the work they do.
I would say thank you. I'm so grateful to begin with. It's not right that we've seen record numbers of resignations among people serving in public health because this has become so political and so divisive. But I would say you are the reason that I sleep at night, because I know that there are amazing scientists and public health workers out there who are doing everything they can to keep us safe. So I would say thank you, and I hope you get all the encouragement and all the support from your families and communities to keep going, because it's going to be a collective effort to get us out of this pandemic.
Do you see hope in the fact that this vaccine was developed at record speed and scientists around the world pitched in?
I do see hope. I think we have to remind people that the average time it takes to develop a vaccine is 10 years. That doesn't mean doing it in 10 months was bad. It means we need to be quicker for other disease areas too. It shouldn't be taking us so long to develop a malaria vaccine, an HIV vaccine. Some of that is because the science is tricky, but it's also because of bureaucracy. It's also because the diseases that affect poor people and Black and brown people are often deprioritized. What's happened with the COVID-19 vaccine is proof that when you throw billions of dollars, when you throw collaboration, and you properly prioritize a disease or a public health issue, you can have fantastic progress within 10 months or a year.
Dr. Yasmin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Dr. Seema Yasmin, Emmy Award-winning journalist, poet, and Stanford University health communication researcher. Her new book is called Viral BS. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.